have the four legs of the tower, or three legs, coming down to a support structure of some kind, which does get grounded. What do you believe would be the disadvantage, Paul, if that 150 feet of fiberglass tube at the top was made out of steel, and if the towers themselves were grounded? Why would that be a disadvantage to what they're doing? And maybe they want the ability to measure voltages or currents in that square chunk of stainless steel wire on top. So maybe that's why they temporarily float it, but I bet you there's some relays that can flip that grounds it when it's in actual operation. So any of the towers that I've ever seen, Paul, self-standing or guide, usually are very well grounded at the base. WS2N, K2IW.
I never read a reason for it, but I guess that, let's say, hit a lightning bolt, instead of a lightning bolt going straight down one of the towers, it would go down on an angle, it looked like about a 30 degree angle, further away from the towers themselves. So, you know, it would be essentially keeping the current even further away from the rocket launch pad itself. By the way, I looked at the pictures, and they did say one of the towers does have a lot of soot on it, you know, on that fiberglass piece going up. The other ones look good, but I haven't seen any close-up pictures of, you know, I've been looking, and there's no close-up pictures of any of the damage. The strong back that holds the rocket is pretty well damaged, but it's still standing up in the air. So, and then the article that I've read, most of the articles I get come out of a NASA site, so I could look for it, reread it. And I believe they even call it, it's almost like a creating a Faraday cage for lightning. Back to you.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, so that no matter what angle the lightning comes in at, it's got to get past a whole lot of wire to get to the actual rocket that's on the launch pad. And therefore, the chances of it being struck are very slim. There is a set of rules for the New York City fire protection, which states that there is no documented evidence of a habitable structure being adjacent to a well-grounded radio tower that the habitable structure was ever struck with lightning. As long as it fulfills the requirement of being inside of a 120-foot diameter sphere. If you take a 120-foot diameter sphere, as far as a paper diagram is concerned, and lay it up against your grounded tower, as long as your structure that you worry about, the habitable structure, is outside of that sphere, not touching it, while the sphere is up against the grounded tower, then it's being thoroughly protected from lightning. So maybe there's some kind of set of rules like that. You can read about this in the Polyphaser book. Polyphaser has got a very nice book on the subject of lightning and lightning protection techniques. Now, the actual payload on Launch Pad 40 has all of this thrusting capability. Is there a belief that some of the volatile materials that were on the payload could have initiated the event of that explosion, Paul? What's the probability of that? And by the way, let me drop. From what you're now telling me, I'm getting the impression that the payload had a lot of thrusting capability, that once it was put into orbit, probably a geosynchronous orbit, it has the ability to position itself for the next 10 years or so. So there may have been a hell of a lot of very volatile hypergolic fuels on that payload. And if any of that started leaking for any reason, I think that could have initiated the event. So it sounds to me like there's a possibility the payload started the problem. I'm guessing that's being investigated, and I'm guessing that hasn't been ruled out so far. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2IW in the TechNet.
read that nothing has been ruled out, but that is one of the things that they think is going down to zero, because they have all kinds of pressure sensors and reefs on all the tanks, and you know, they know what the status is of all the stuff, and there was no drop in anything, you know, at the time. At the time, they were, of course, loading cryogenic fuel on the first and second stage, but the third, well, essentially the third stage, which is the payload itself, with these hydrazine fuel on board, that was, you know, they get readings on that. So they're pretty confident that they don't think it was the payload. And so far, they don't think it's a hot oxygen tank. I saw a picture of, they have a camera looking up at the oxygen tank inside the spacecraft. It's a blue-looking color. And you can see the bottom of the oxygen tank. And not only with cameras, but there's all kinds of pressure readings, temperature readings all over these things. And they didn't see any anomaly yet, so that's why it's still a big mystery. And they won't be able to proceed, really, until they find this problem. They have $10 billion, would it be, dollars worth of scheduled launches. They have 70 launches on their manifest over the next couple of few years. So to get to that, they know they have two launch pads that they can launch from. They can launch from 39A from
repeater timeout. Repeater timeout. Cancel.
They could launch from 39B from Florida. I said it again. 39A is the one they took over. And then there's one in California. Launch Complex 4. I think it's 4C, they call it. They've taken that one over. They're leasing that from the government. And that they've flown out of before, and that's ready to go. In fact, that was one of their next flights. They're going to launch 10 Iridium satellites out of that one in a couple of weeks. I guess that's all going to be on hold until they figure out what this is. If it's an external problem, something on a pad, something from the launch complex itself, yeah, then they can go ahead and just, you know, fix that at some future time. And we'll make the repairs if they are at Vandenberg, California, and then go ahead with their launch. But if it's on a rocket, I think they're in big trouble. Back to you, Dan.
My understanding of the way you put something in synchronous orbit is you use a two-stage booster to get it up to a moderately high parking orbit. Then usually the payload has on the back of it a solid-state apogee kick motor, which kicks it up to the synchronous altitude. And I think that apogee kick motor has to be fired twice in a Hallman maneuver in order to get a circularized orbit at geosynchronous altitude. So you've got this, I think, a solid-state apogee kick motor mounted on the back end of the payload. And if anything false alarmed that, my goodness, could that create a lot of grief. Has any words been said about whether or not the aperture kick motor was involved in this accident, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
No, and the thrusters and the rocket that pushes themselves to eventually the geosynchronous orbit are all on that one. Those same set of tanks, these hydrazine tanks. You're probably thinking of the Castor motor, the Castor 30, or actually Castor 30C now. Like for instance, that the orbital ATK is using for the Antares launch. You know, they launch with they're going to be launching with liquid fuel boost. rocket with liquid fuel boosters, which we use solid booster rockets on the side of our rockets. So there's a lot of different ways of getting there. Now the newest way that they've been doing recently, and probably half a dozen launches so far, is instead of this what you call kick mode, they're using ion drives now. There's been, I think, a half a dozen of them launched, a couple by SpaceX, and also Ariane 5 has put up, not too long ago, they put up two very large satellites. I mean, when I say large, each one, I think, like 10,000 pounds or something. And incorporated in that is these ion engines. And they eventually get them to geosynchronous orbit. The downside of that is, let's say you would like to get it to a location as soon as possible to start operation and make money. So, you know, most people would like to get it into geosynchronous orbit probably within a week or so. The ion engines that sometimes take months, a couple of months before you're able to even get into orbit, and then they have to go through their checkout procedures before they start operations. But they're becoming more and more popular, these ion engines. Less expensive, very effective, and very reliable. And that's probably all I know about that. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2N.
As I see it, Paul, the good news on an ion engine is it gives you a lot of thrusting efficiency. Very little mass gives you a whole lot of thrust in seconds times pounds, seconds times newtons. That's the good news. The bad news is the thrust is kind of small, so if you're using that to get up to apogee of a geosynchronous orbit, it's going to take you, like you said, months or a good fraction of a year. However, when you then get there, if you're using that ion engine in order to do station keeping and to keep the orbit circularized and just to do station keeping, the ion engine sounds to me like an extremely efficient way to do station keeping. And if that ion engine has the right kind of reliability, you could be doing that for 10 or 20 years. Whereas ordinary station keeping, you're going to run out of thrustable fuel in a lot less than that amount of time. So when it comes to geosynchronous orbit, I didn't know that very many or any, I didn't know that any ion engines have been used to get into geosynchronous orbit. How many objects in geosynchronous orbit, Paul, have gotten there by way of an ion engine? Over to you, KQLIW.
There's at least four that I know of. I don't know their names, but I know there were two launched by an Ariane 5 rocket probably about a year and a half ago. Two big satellites. And I don't know who they were for. My guess is one of them is probably from SES. That's the biggest company that does these things, if not both. And then there were at least two by SpaceX that were put up. So they're using it more and more. Now you got the X-37B. That's the spy satellite by the Air Force. Actually, you know, the National Reconnaissance Office, really. They put up these spy satellite things. And that's the one that looks like a small space shuttle and comes back and lands autonomously in California. And that thing now, they say, they've admitted that that has some kind of Hall ion thrusters on board. And that's in low, that's not geosynchronous. That's, I guess, what you would consider a LEO, or low Earth orbit. So they're using it more and more. You're right, I've read station keeping is one of the primary reasons they can move it from one location to another to back up another satellite. Now, Amos, that was the satellite that blew up, was built by Israel. Not Israel itself, but, you know, from an Israel company, Spacecom. And it was scheduled to be That company was scheduled to be bought up by a Beijing company right after launch. And that went down the tubes. I think that deal, from what I read, is off. So it's a problem. Iridium is sticking by SpaceX. They have this flight going at the end of the month, supposedly going up at the end of the month from California with 10 Iridium satellites. And I think they've signed up with SpaceX for at least 6 or 7 more launches. So each one like carrying 10 of these satellites. So, I'm sure SpaceX is really trying to figure out what the problem is. Well, I'm concerned because two Junes ago, when SpaceX blew up about 2 minutes after they left the launch pad, we dropped it. We traced the problem back, SpaceX did, to the second stage oxygen tank. Inside the oxygen tank, they carry a smaller helium tank. And they said that the strut, which is one of the struts that are holding the tank in place, because it accelerated up to 5 G's, was undersized by the contractor. As they had these struts, and they broke free, and the helium tank probably broke a line or something, and instantly pressurized this oxygen tank, over-pressurized it, and blew it up. What I'm concerned is, I hope they got that right, because it looks like the explosion emanated from the same location. If you look at the pictures, the slow motion pictures that you can see on the computer now, this Falcon 9 blowing up. So, I hope they got it right. Maybe they fixed something, but that fix has got, caused another problem. Like the Heisenberg effect. I got the guy's name right. The second you look at something, you're going to change something. Back to you there.
Yeah, I forget what that's called. Heisenberg uncertainty principle. When it comes to ionic thrusting of a satellite that's going to go to geosynchronous orbit, to do all of that apogee kick motor function, which is a lot of thrusting, I can see how doing that with an ionic engine would take a month of Sundays. I wonder if they do a solid state apogee kick motor firing so that the apogee gets up to geosynchronous orbit, and then the Holloman maneuver is that you do 180 degrees away in orbit another blast to circularize the orbit. I wonder if that second firing is done over a long period of time, cyclically, with a ionic engine. Have they ever said that they get to the apogee on one side of the orbit with a solid-state engine, and then use the ionic engine over a period of time to circularize the orbit? Have they ever said words along those lines, Paul? WS2N, K2IW? Because that sounds like a kind of a crafty way of doing it, without spending a whole lot of time.
I thought they light the ion engines every time they come to perigee, because that's the time they're moving fastest. And they, similar to what they would do with the chemical engines, but because it's such a low thrust, it just takes, instead of a couple of perigee movements by the spacecraft and circularizing at apogee, it's probably the same thing, but just many, many, many times, like months, 3, 4, 5 months. But I don't know. I'll have to look into it. One other thing I want to talk about is next month I want to see this abort test flight by Blue Origin. I know I've talked about them a lot of times on the net. Just wanted to mention that they're going to run that test on the New Shepard spacecraft. It's launched 4 times successfully and come back and landed vertically on the desert floor out in Texas successfully, and this will be the fifth flight, but they're going to actually try an abort test in pounds of thrust, one motor down the center, which will pull the six passengers away in case they have to do it. That's Blue Origin, another company we've talked about, but they don't get much press because right now they're not going orbital. They're doing a suborbital flight. Back to you.
Run that by again, Paul. Did you say six passengers can potentially be on that craft? Is that what you said, go ahead?
Yeah, that's their plan. And supposedly a pilot and a co-pilot. So I don't know, up to eight people inside this one craft. It looks like a pretty good sized craft. When you see it up close, they're manufacturing these things in Seattle, Washington. That's the spacecraft itself. That's attached to the top of the booster. The whole thing is called New Shepard, named after Alan Shepard, but it's called New Shepard. And they've successfully launched this thing to suborbital, which is over the common line. 62 kilometers up, call it 100 miles up. And successfully separated the spacecraft from the booster that's come down with these three big blue parachutes. And at the same time, the booster comes down. It's only got one rocket, by the way. Now we're talking about different rockets. This one is hydrogen and oxygen, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. And that thing comes down. And rarely comes down fast when you look at the videos. And it lights the rocket last couple of seconds. Comes in for a dead landing like it was taken off. Back to you there.
Yeah, the most ideal landing would look exactly like a takeoff, but you play the movie backwards. run by the Iridium situation, Paul. If I'm not mixed up, Iridium was a constellation of satellites 10 or so years ago, which everyone believed was going to be the space equivalent of cell phones. Everybody's going to walk around with this very large cell phone-like thing that I think on S-band or KU-band talked up to the satellite. The satellites relayed the message through that constellation, and in theory, you could talk to anybody anywhere else in the world. And if I remember correctly, people were making predictions that this thing was going to make a fortune. In reality, it was kind of pricey. Not many people signed up for it. And as I remember, the Department of Defense took over the Iridium satellite system, and they're using it as a global communication system that the commercial world couldn't sell enough people on the idea. Not enough people would sign up for it, so it wasn't commercially viable. If I understand correctly, that constellation of satellites, and I think all of them were medium orbit satellites, and I think that was Iridium. And so now if more Iridium satellites are being launched, does that mean they're either making a more complete constellation, or some of the earlier ones have worn out, and this is being done for a military operation? Because I didn't think Iridium had very much commercial business, if I remember correctly. WS2N, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, the military uses Iridium, but I remember reading it that non-secure type channels. I guess maybe if somebody wants to call home or something. But the military has their own constellation of secret satellites, probably put up by NRO, National Reconnaissance Office, that they probably communicate with for all their missions. But I believe commercial people are signed up with Iridium. Not sure about the business model behind it. I am sure how it got started, and you're right, it was going to be the, cat's meow, everybody was going to use these things. Just needed to look like an HT with a large larger rubber duck than we would have for 2 meters sticking out of there. But, I'm not sure what bands they were using. But, they started out with the thought of using 77 satellites. That was the goal. And somebody looked up on the periodic table and they said, oh, iridium's got 77 electrons, so let's call it iridium. And then as time went on, they realized, well, we only need 66 satellites. But it's too late. They couldn't change the name. I'm dropping. But they did add backups. They added, like, you know, another 10 satellites or so as backups in case one fails. And you're right, they're in relatively low Earth orbit. They're probably up, you know, 450 miles or something like that. So, yeah, and they've all got different inclinations, and that's why they're pretty much launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base. If you want to do a polar launch of any kind, you go to Vandenberg, and you could set these things up where you can get different angles, you know, different inclination planes for all their different satellites. So they apparently talk to one another. The satellites talk to one another. So you make a contact. You might go through one iridium satellite, go through another iridium satellite, back down again. But now they've developed these, let's call them iridium satellites on steroids, where they're able to handle a lot more traffic for each satellite. Whatever they were doing, you know, now, you know, probably multiply times 100 or something. Let me drop it. I don't know the numbers, but they've increased the throughput on all these different satellites. So now they've got dozens and dozens ready to fly, and SpaceX is on board to do that. And right now they said they're pretty much configured for SpaceX's setup, the way they're going to mount inside the fairing. And when they do that, I saw Orbitcom 11, they call it. There were 11 satellites that were launched at one time from SpaceX. You see live film after it takes off, live pictures coming back from the satellite. You see every one separating from this whole setup that, you know, after it got to orbit. They did that on that one. And I would imagine they're probably going to do the same thing on the Iridium satellites. So, that's pretty much it. Again, the frequencies, I don't remember. But we'll turn it back. You think, one other topic, since we got time, I can bring up one problem on the International Space Station you might like.
I do want to hear about the International Space Station. One thing I'm going to discuss ahead of this, I want to call the Holloman maneuver, or Holloman maneuver, however it's pronounced. You shoot yourself up to a apogee that equals the geosynchronous orbit, for instance, and then in order to circularize the orbit, you have to do a burn while you're at apogee. The burn you do at apogee affects your orbital altitude at the other side of the orbit, 180 degrees away. So when you're up at 12 o'clock, the burn you do is going to determine how high your orbit is going to be at 6 o'clock, if you know what I mean. That's if it was a polar orbit. So to do a burn when you're at perigee, which you were mentioning earlier, that burn would not change your perigee altitude. It would be changing your apogee altitude. And if you're trying to circularize an orbit, you're trying to raise the low point. Therefore, you're going to do the burn when you're at the high point. Do you see what I'm saying on that one, Paul? WS2N, K2IW.
Is that what I said? I'm probably thinking of the MOM spacecraft, the one that the Indian, from India, they launched that. That's the their Mars mission. They call it MOM mission. So that successfully is now in orbit around Mars. But to get there, Yeah, they did that. They first put it into orbit around the Earth, and then every perigee they lit their rocket. I think it took them 5 or 6 times, and finally they were able to break free of the Earth's gravity well and off to Mars. But yeah, I know. Yeah, you got to get to the high point. When you change it, you know, when you ignite that, eventually you're going to circularize your orbit. Or you could even change your inclination at that high point as well. Okay, over to the space station.
Yeah, let's hear what's going on with the space station. And I think 3 astronauts just came back home. And so after seeing thousands of sunrises in space, now for the first time in 6 months, they're seeing a real sunrise on the Earth. I seem to remember reading a report along those lines. Over to you, Paul. K2LIW.
Yeah, well, I think they see 16 sunrises every day. But Jeff Williams, the American astronaut, he came back with 2 Soviets. Usually it's 1 Soviet, and then usually somebody from the European Space Agency, and then him. But this time around, it was 2 Soviets and him. So now he's got the record collectively, you know, not at one time, collectively over, like, I don't know, 540 days or something in space, because he's been on so many different missions. But that's Jeff Williams, and he's a ham, by the way, and he made some ham contacts when he was up there. So yeah, they landed successfully in Kazakhstan on a Soyuz rocket, and I did see that. That was during the astronomy net last Tuesday. Craig was talking about it. He was on live at that time, and they came down. And beautiful, clear day. Let me drop it.
Hey, there, John.
And well, makes a long story short. Before we turn it over, I think it sounded like Eric. It was successful. They have 6 rockets that fire, landing rockets, right at the last second. Big cloud of dust. They got out, they carried them out, they bring them to the medical tent, and eventually they send them back to their respective countries. Back to you, Dick. I don't know if that was Eric or not.
Yeah, let's pick up Eric and then come back to the space station. KE2EJ, K2RW, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I was listening to you guys talking about iridium. I'm sorry, I'm taking you back to one conversation behind. I just wanted to say that, iridium went bankrupt. It was started by 2 guys with a contract with Motorola, but they emerged as a very strong company. They're not owned by the military. It's a publicly traded company based in Virginia. It's very active. Their whole philosophy changed through the bankruptcy, and that's how they became very successful. By the way, the name Iridium actually comes from it. We determined it took 77 LEOs to make full coverage, and if you look up on the periodic table, atomic number 77 is Iridium. Just my 2 cents worth. K2RW, K2J.
He missed the first part, Dick.
Yeah, the number 77 in Iridium, Paul did mention that. From your point of view, is Iridium being used by a significant number of people? Does it have a favorable cash flow these days? Is that how the financing is taking place for launching a bunch more Iridium satellites? Do you know anyone who has used Iridium? Have you used Iridium? Tell us anything you know about Iridium. And are those LEOs or MEOs Iridium? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. They're LEOs. Actually, they have something called Iridium Next, which is what they're starting to launch. I don't know the specifics of it. I talked to a friend of mine that's actually involved in it. Yeah, I've used it. We at the station have used it. What they wound up doing that made them successful is they went into niche markets and offered services to other organizations. They're very active in the maritime and the aircraft business. Of course, they have coverage. You can be on either of the poles and still have service. So they're not after the general public in terms of what the devices are. They do more than just phones. They do data and a whole lot of other stuff. So, yeah, they're a healthy company, actually. So, back to you, Dick.
KB2IQN with a comment.
Christopher recognized. Go right ahead, Chris. You know about Iridium? You got it, Chris. Are you on the road?
That's a Roger. I am mobile. There was a discussion at the HOPE conference about the Iridium satellites, specifically about it being used for data transmission from many kinds of boats, like large boats and worldwide communications. It's very slow, data-wise, but it is essentially like one of the few ways you can actually get internet in, let's say, obscure places of the ocean. KB2IQN.
I'll add to that. It covers places where even the Intel Marisats don't cover.
Gee, that's kind of nice. I didn't know Iridium went all the way to the poles. I knew it went a little bit beyond the Arctic Circle. But could I be standing on the North Pole or the South Pole and talk by Iridium? I didn't think it had enough altitude to do that or enough inclination of orbit. Over to you on that one, Eric.
Yeah, as far as I know, that's true. I mean, you can talk to Bill Baker. He took his satellite phone to the pole.
Iridium itself, you've used it, Eric. What is the uplink frequency and downlink frequency? Is it S-band or KU-band? Over to you, Eric.
I believe the whole thing's S-band. It's simpler, similar to what we use as PCS.
Is it using frequencies? If it's S-band, are the frequencies somewhat similar to 802.11 frequencies, around 2.3 gigahertz? Over to you, Eric.
No, I'm not certain. I can look it up for you.
And I think you're saying you or Bill Baker has used it. I presume the thing in your hand is like a very large cell phone. Isn't it about 5 pounds or so, the thing in your hand? And the thing in your hand, does that give you communication for a couple of hours? Over to you, Eric.
Maybe you could describe the antenna as well. Remember, I brought that up before, Dick.
Yeah, tell us what you know about that antenna. How many hours? How many pounds? Tell us whatever you know, Eric. How many dollars per hour to use it?
No, I couldn't give you the answer to what the rates are. They're not cheap, or at least they weren't cheap. Now I assume they're getting cheaper. Depends upon what year. The first phones were big and lunky and had a huge antenna, and they only ran for like about 20 minutes of dark on. The new ones look like cell phones, just a little bit bigger. I've seen the ones which have the fold-out antennas, and I've seen the ones with the antennas built right on the top of it, so, you know, it looks like a Motorola phone these days.
My goodness, Iridium has come a long way from the beginning. So it sounds to me like they're moving in the direction of being economically viable. If they're putting up a lot more satellites, and that's what the poll is telling us, somebody is financing it, and the person financing it must think he's going to get return on investment. So it sounds like it's turning into the green from the red. Is that true, Eric? KEQEJ, KGRIW?
Well, again, it's a publicly traded company, and usually they have to at least stay not in the debt column and head towards the profitable column to be active and maintain themselves on the stock market.
KB2IQN Mobile, KQRIW, Chris, sounds to me like you've got friends that have used Iridium, or you know people who know people who have used Iridium. Tell me whatever you know about how often it was used. Were they satisfied with the service? Are they going to go back to use more of it? KB2IQN Mobile, KQRIW in the TechNet.
KB2IQN. Well, I don't have any friends, direct friends, that have used it. The talk at the HOPE conference was about someone making a worldwide trip and using it for a transmission of internet data to be able to make blog posts about where they were at what times. and there was a small strip of area around India where the Iridium satellites didn't work at the time. They may have had a satellite replacement since then, I don't know. But I can get you that talk, because all of those talks are online and available for free at Livestream, KB2IQN.
Just looked up a couple of things, Dick.
Okay, you're looking up a couple of things. And Chris, in South Africa, the conference that was recently held there by the computer people, I wonder if any of those people were tempted to use Iridium. Some of those guys are pretty high-tech people. Isn't that true, Chris? Over to you.
The internet service was, that you're talking about the Debian conference in Cape Town, Africa, in late July, or that ended in late July. They were using land-based internet from the University of Cape Town, and either that or cell-based internet, nothing iridium-based as far as I know.
Sounds to me like they could have used iridium if they could have afforded it, because at Debian conference, they did have a connectivity problem to the rest of the world, I am guessing. Is that true, Chris?
Negative. They would not have used iridium for two reasons. The conference really needs gigabit, like, to the internet because of all the video streaming. It's very typical for many of the conferences, like the Chaos Communication Congress or the FOSDEM conference that happens in Brussels or what have you. All those conferences that do video streaming need a lot of data, you know, at a fairly rapid rate, and that's not what you use iridium for. Iridium is an expensive, relatively slow service that is very commonly used on boats because it's available in a wide area, and it's satellite-based also, which means there's a lot of latency, like a half second of latency, which is also not something great because it means there's a lot of packets in mid-transit and so forth. So it's a little bit more complicated. But it's just not what you would normally use for a land-based conference. KB2IQN.
Yeah, one of the things that Eric might be able to tell us is because the Iridium satellites are low Earth orbit satellites, 400 miles light, as opposed to geosynchronous orbit, 22,300 miles. You know, six Earth radii out there, you know, a tenth of the way to the moon, so to speak. It's that very long distance at the speed of light out to a geosynchronous satellite and back down that gives you that half second of delay, which can become very annoying, where both people are talking and then both people are listening and talking on top of each other. If iridium is at low Earth orbit, it sounds to me like it doesn't have anywhere near as much latency, except for the fact that if packets have to be transferred from one satellite to another to relay the message, maybe that's where the latency is coming from. So maybe Eric is going to, Eric looks into this, maybe he's going to tell us more about this. KE2EJ, if you're back, K2RAW on the TechNet.
K2RAW is K2EJ. Well, it appears that the next generation of satellites that the SpaceX is launching for them, they're going to be launching 70 out of them. The voice circuit that you use in the handset, or the mobile terminals as they call them, that's L-band, and they can do 128 kilobits, so that's really slow. The fixed terminal on L-band will run at 1.2 megabits, and the fixed data terminals and the data terminal services in Ka-band, and that'll do 8 megabits per slot, per channel. You could have, you know, 1,000 units doing all the same thing, so... You know, it is one satellite, there's going to be a maximum bit rate that you can pass through it. As far as getting connectivity, I started reading there's multiple processors in there. Each one is literally a Cisco switch looking for the nearest switch. So I believe there is some data handing off from one satellite to another to get to the ground station.
Now, you told us the very slow data rate at L-band. Run that number by one more time. I missed that number, Paul. I mean, Eric. So, that low data rate in L-band, does that easily support audio, but much too slow for usual data? KE2EJ, K2LIW?
I don't know why you'd say that's not too slow for data. You never used a 1200 baud modem, or maybe even a 9600 baud modem. This is 128 kilobits, okay, so this is 128K modem, as opposed to a 9.6K modem, so it's a reasonable speed. Now, but that, the reason for it being slow and low like that is not having a dish pointed at the satellite. You're using just a little antenna on top of the radio.
Okay, so those number of baud and kilobits can easily support multiple channels of audio, but I presume it's much too slow for live video. Am I correct on that one, Paul? I mean, Eric, even with compression techniques on the video?
Well, that all depends upon what you want to do. I can send you really lovely pictures at that rate, but, you know, that'll be like one picture every half a second or every 2 seconds, depending upon how I choose to use my compression and what my frame rate is. It's not intended for, I don't think it was ever intended as a replacement for live streaming video, but we have this something called coordinated cellular modems, which in essence you take 5 cellular audio circuits and I send you live video and you put it on the air, of course, minus the latency, which would be the processing time of putting those 5 or 6 streams back together. So there's ways of doing it. But at the time that it was invented, which was like in the late 80s, the concept of moving video over a slow circuit like that didn't really exist. Whereas today, we pretty much can do it. But the fixed ground station, which has the tracking antenna and the dish pointing at the satellite, is capable of passing video without any problem. The handheld unit at those rates, it's not going to happen.
Now, here's a tough question for you, Eric. If I'm using Iridium handheld device and I'm doing live audio and I'm talking to my buddy in Germany, make a guess as to what kind of latency I might experience. And I presume the latency is because the packets have to be relayed through a number of satellites to get there. So would I hear the latency when having an audio communication with my buddy in Darmstadt, Germany? Over to you, Eric, K2LIW.
So I'll tell you this much. We used a bunch of those satellite phones for production work when we did live from Vienna. A couple of other places in Europe. And when I was in Poland, I had one. The video always came much later than the audio. The audio on the phone was almost instantaneous. Oh, you couldn't tell. You weren't waiting for the guy on the other end to hear you and then respond. So, you know, I would probably say the delays were in not seconds, but in hundreds of milliseconds.
Okay, so that's a lot better than geosynchronous satellite. But I think you're saying you were transmitting audio, and the video came a lot later. I presume the video that you were getting had to be accumulated over a period of time, and it wasn't live, real-time video. Is that true, Eric, K2LIW?
No, it was actually, I had two paths. One was through satellite, and one was through transoceanic fiber. The transoceanic fiber was the fastest. I think the delay time there, because of the MPEG processing and that kind of stuff, most people don't realize it. When you encode video into MPEG, you may have actually made the output 2 or 3 seconds later, because you need future and previous frames in order for the compression algorithm to work in the first place. So, although we have stuff now that'll actually do it within 4 or 6 frames. When we first started, like the original IBM MPEG chipset in real time, was something like 6 seconds between you stick the video in and it comes out the other end.
Wow. But if I only have to look four or six frames forward and aft. And if you're transmitting something like 60 frames per second, my guess is the human eye might not see that delay if that's a small number of frames you have to look forward and aft. Over to you, Eric, KQLIW.
Let's put it this way. The average person will begin to see video go out of lip sync with the audio. Well, I can tell you when it's one frame off. Most people can't. Usually within 12 or 15 frames, and it's 30 frames a second, not 60. We tend to not use 720p and long haul, whereas we'll do as 1080i because we'd actually take up a little less bandwidth to the detail that we want to get. Although some people will do the 720p even, and they'll pay for it in bandwidth that you use. But, each one is a compromise in terms of how you get it across. The satellite circuit may be 3, 4, or 5 seconds, depending upon what's going on.
Okay, if you're sending 33 frames per second, one frame per 33 milliseconds, roughly, and you can see that lack of lip sync of 33 milliseconds, you know what you're looking for. From time to time on my digital television, I will see audio and video that look to me like they're a quarter of a second or half a second out of sync. Is that something that's taking place in my local receiver, or is it more likely to be taking place at the source? KE2EJ, KQLIW.
Well, let's put it this way. Nobody would deliberately transmit stuff that's out of lip sync. Actually, the technology has gotten stuff that we have these little counters buried in the stream so that the receiver can figure out where lip sync belongs in the latest receivers. Whether the broadcast station is transmitting implements that is a whole other story. The average person can see 15, 20 frames and know that something's wrong. That's, 15 frames, a half a second.
I accept that. But you're saying the very sharp eye of KE2EJ can see 33 milliseconds of out of sync. One frame, you're able to resolve one frame out of sync, Eric, is what I think you said earlier. KQLIW.
33 milliseconds is a field. 16 milliseconds is a frame. I'm backwards. Sorry, I keep doing that to myself. Yeah, 33 milliseconds. I can pretty much tell. When it's 66 milliseconds, I can definitely tell without question, and I can prove it.
I'm going to take your word for it. You know what to look for. Right now, what resolution is being over-the-air broadcast? Are we talking about 2K and moving toward 4K, and 4K is going to become more popular? And is that where it's going to stop? Tell me about over-the-air resolution and even in cable resolution. But let's talk about over-the-air resolution. What over-the-air resolution, if I had the latest and the greatest set, could I be receiving? And what percentage of the programming I'm likely to see will have that? KE2EJ, KQLIW.
KQLIW, KE2EJ, where do you want to begin? There's 36 different flavors, okay, but the ones that are basically used. If we're talking over the air like CBS, NBC, Channel 4, Channel 2, not their off channels, their advertised channel. Whereas CBS and NBC and PBS are transmitting 1080i, which is, in essence, you call that 2K, all right? ABC and Fox, they use 720p, and that's sort of like 1K, really. It's less. It's not more. But for most classical standards, we do not transmit 1080p, which, by the way, is the same resolution as 1080i. It's just that instead of sending two fields of information, we send each field with all the information. And, of course, that takes up more bandwidth. That's why we don't transmit 1080p over the air. Although with the ATSC 3, we'll be able to do that and more. and still be within the 6 megahertz of your TV channel. 4K at this point in time ain't never going to be on the, actually it'll be Ultra HD, not 4K, which is 3.5, you know, 3.5 thousand lines instead of 4,000 lines, and it's an even division by 1080. Let me hit a drop. Now, tell me what else you want to hear.
Okay, so it sounds to me like periodically I can see 2K over the air right now. In the near future, I'm going to be seeing 3.5K. And is that likely to become a standard that will be used a lot, or do I have to wait a whole lot of years before that's going to happen? What's your guess, Eric? KE2AJ, K2LIW?
I don't think you'll have to worry about it because of what, it took you 20 years to buy a digital TV. It'll probably take you another 20 years, you won't be around. Well, the format of ATSC3 is at the end of its approval process. A bunch of people are trying to get the FCC to fast track it so that we can actually get it on the air. And then, of course, you have to go and pay for it. You have to get the consumers to buy the TV sets. And not only is it Ultra HD, but we have something called HDR, which is high definition resolution, whereas at the color depth, it will no longer be 16 million pixels. It was, you know, 16 million colors. You'll now have 64 million colors of reproduction. The HDR actually does make an improvement in a lot of respects. But if you want to see active material that's being done in 4K, the only place you're going to get it now is either off of a DirecTV satellite, or if you're lucky enough and your cable system is running a UHD channel. And right now you have to have the right people's equipment to get the right stuff together, because everybody's not exactly doing exactly the same format. So, you know, there's still a little more things that are going to shake out in that world. You will probably see more 4K content as time goes on, because they're transferring films in 4K, even though they may only be releasing it in 2K. There's lots of funny little games going on, editing systems are moving into the 4K realm. Don't forget, movies are being done in 4K and 8K, so, you know, the equipment's been there for a while, and the HDR, the high dynamic range stuff is actually coming more in place faster for the film people.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
We only lost your identification, so don't worry, Eric. Is there enough demand of the public for 4K? Is question number one. Yes, I could be getting it by way of satellite TV. I am guessing very few of the channels on cable TV are capable of supporting 4K. I'm talking now about coaxial cable. When it comes to fiber optic cable, I suspect they can more easily support 4K.
Of course, it's exactly the same. The thing about fiber that you don't think about in cable, they're exactly the same in terms of bandwidth available.
Yeah, give me a couple of words on that. I've been naively thinking the fiber has got huge bandwidth capability, whereas coaxial cable does not. Why is that thinking wrong, Eric? Correct me on that, K2LAW.
Well, you don't realize it, but when you get Fios, you're really getting your cable system stuffed into a piece of fiber. You're getting stuff that's been modulated in QAM, put on an RF carrier, and then turned into light. And the gear that does that only operates within certain frequency ranges. And